Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to the Economics for Rebels, the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. Not too long ago, it was an act of rebellion to pursue economics as if nature mattered. This rebellion continues. This is a podcast dedicated to exploring the economics of just and sustainable transformations. Conversations with and for those who are ready to act on rapid and radical change for people and planet. Welcome to our podcast. I am your host, Alexandra Kovács, and you are listening to the Economics for Rebels podcast. More and more of the rich and famous are taking up climate activism and trying to convince the world that we all need to act now. But what is their message? Ecological economics is about realizing that business as usual no longer works. Instead of techno-optimism, we need real system change. But what exactly are climate elites saying? What is the role of philanthropy in climate politics? And how does this all feed into sustainability transitions? Do they help our cause or just defer fundamental change? Today's guest, Eduard Morena, will help us figure this all out. Eduard is a lecturer in politics and history at the University of London Institute in Paris. His research focuses on different dimensions of international climate governance, especially the role of climate philanthropy and climate elites in international climate governance. He published a book in 2016 called The Price of Climate Action: Philanthropic Foundations in the International Climate Debate. Welcome, Edouard.
Thanks. Thanks for the invitation.
So let's see who these climate elites are. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Al Gore, Bill Gates, Elon Musk, Michael Bloomberg, Anne Hidalgo, Leonardo DiCaprio, Stella McCartney, all famous people. And they are all on the climate bandwagon. Are they what you call in your work climate elites?
Yeah, definitely. I think they definitely qualify as climate elites. I guess they're also the kind of visible side of the iceberg. I mean, I think this kind of idea of climate elites also includes maybe less visible actors, but nonetheless very important actors within the kind of international climate kind of policy space that kind of gravitates around the UNFCCC. And so that, you know, that includes people who are kind of thought leaders, people who work in kind of PR experts. It includes also, you know, a few kind of experts or people kind of who also work in management consultancy. So I guess my understanding of climate elites is goes beyond just those more kind of visible actors who definitely form part of that group, but it also, I guess, includes individuals, and I think the individual dimension is really important, who kind of collectively form kind of a group with a shared kind of theory of change of what's required to address the climate issue, and also who push kind of a shared narrative around climate action. And so I guess that's more or less what I include within this kind of climate elite category.
Well, in my understanding, in that sense, Greta Thunberg is not a climate elite, or is she? I mean, she's a visible person, yes, but definitely with a slightly different agenda than all the other actors. So what would you say to that?
I think, you know, that's a really good question. I mean, and I think, you know, that's it is a good question in the sense that in certain ways she could be considered as forming part of this elite. And to a certain extent, I think that the actors that you mentioned would very much like her to form part of the group, you know, and you know, the fact that she's invited to Davos to speak, the fact that, you know, I mean, it was, I started collecting photos of her where she's kind of having selfies with kind of famous people. So there's clearly an attempt, I think, on behalf of these actors to include her or to make her part of that group or to be associated with her. However, I mean, and I think especially, you know, when we listen to her politics and we hear her speak, I think she, what differentiates her maybe from those actors is that she does push a narrative that is, for me, quite different from the elites that I mentioned. and one that is also very centered on the bottom-up action and popular mobilization, which again, I think is a clear distinction with the approach that's being pushed by this kind of category of elites that I mentioned, which is, as their title emphasizes, is elitist. You know, I think they, you know, what really characterizes these actors is actually their distrust in popular mobilization and in their belief that in fact they are enlightened and that they are best placed to address the climate issue. You know, there's this constant, and in the interviews that I was able to do with them, what's always been fascinating is how they constantly kind of refer to this idea that, you know, the issue is about getting the right people in the room. You know, if you get the right people in the room who are supposedly powerful, who control financial, economic power, political power, you know, if you get them in the room and you get them talking to one another, they can solve the climate crisis. You know, I think that's really what drives their approach to climate action. And at the same time, they also see Greta Thunberg, Fridays for Future, mobilizations outside, not so much as a kind of a political force, but as a supporting force, you know, in support of the kind of narrative that they're trying to push. You know, I think that's how I would kind of characterize their relationship as well to kind of movements and to figures in movements, and particularly people like Greta Thunberg.
They're kind of implying that they have a kind of homogeneous narrative on what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
What exactly is the message of these people?
There are various concepts that have been kind of circulated. I mean, one that I really like is one that was imagined by an academic called Jesse Goldstein in a book he wrote on, and I think he published it in 2018 on clean tech, where he refers to this idea of a new green spirit of capitalism. And I think that kind of captures quite well the kind of narrative that they push. So it's one really that is centered on the idea that, you know, capitalism is in crisis. I think there's a recognition that capitalism, as it currently functions, doesn't work, that it hasn't sufficiently factored in certain externalities. So it's about, you know, integrating those externalities within capitalism, and in particular the issue of, you know, nature and the climate crisis. So there's a recognition that capitalism in crisis, so it's about promoting a better capitalism, a reformed capitalism, you could say. And so if you look at people like Al Gore, for instance, you know, he imagined and developed this concept of sustainable capitalism. If you look at people like Hunter Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute, he talks about natural capitalism. So again, this kind of idea that capitalism remains the kind of best system to address the climate crisis, but also to bring kind of prosperity to our societies, but at the same time that in its current form it's failed, so we need to reform it, we need to tweak it essentially in order to make it function better. And you know, behind that is also the idea obviously that, you know, profit and climate action actually can go hand in hand, are mutually reinforcing. So you can see how the kind of the approach that they push is it reflects kind of intra-capitalist struggles as well, this kind of struggle within capitalism between different factions of capitalism to try and push a specific understanding or idea of how capitalism can be reformed and how it could function better. And so that's what I find interesting with these elites, is how it's not just about pushing a narrative, it's actually also about pushing class interests to a certain extent, or sectoral interests even. You know, so the focus, for instance, on technology, the focus on clean tech, the focus on the role of finance, you know, as a force of good, you know, that's a real kind of powerful element as well of this group. You know, the connections with technology, clean tech technologies, but also fintech, so financial innovation, is a big part as well of what they're pushing. And at the same time, you know, they also push certain technologies. So this kind of idea of soft energy paths, so through renewables, through energy efficiency, rather than breakthrough technologies like nuclear, for instance. You know, their kind of critique, you know, when you listen to Al Gore, when you listen to the Rocky Mountain Institute, they're very critical of nuclear. And they tend to push certain technology solutions as well. So again, I think that's interesting. That's what I'm interested in, is these kind of intra-capitalist elite struggles and how, you know, what I associate with the current kind of dominant elite group is a particular kind of understanding, let's say, of what is needed to address the climate issue.
In your work, you are quite critical of these climate elites. But I'm really wondering, and you know, I'm the devil's advocate here. Yeah. That, you know, okay, we probably both agree, and also our listeners probably agree, that the solutions they are trying to provide is not going to be adequate. Mm-hmm. To fight climate change. Yeah. On the other hand, we all know that we lack time. So basically their implication that we're running out of time, we need to act now, everyone needs to act now, that could also start changes or initiate changes where we will debate what kind of solutions we need. Mm. But this narrative actually somehow makes humanity realize that yes, yeah, something needs to be done. And then we will only argue what exactly should be done. Okay, we don't really need time to argue too much. But on the other hand, what I'm trying to figure out is whether you think that all their messages are detrimental to our cause, or there are messages that we certainly need.
No, I think their message on urgency is an important one. I think it is, and I think that it's important because absolutely, I agree. I think there is not a lot of time. I think, however, what's interesting is how this message of urgency is systematically coupled to a certain idea of how we should move forward. You know, this kind of idea that there's kind of a one-size-fits-all approach to addressing the climate issue. And I think that's what I have issues with, is this kind of idea that change necessarily happens from the top down, you know. And I think, you know, I've already been asked this question, and what I always respond is how actually change can happen very quickly as well through popular mobilizations. You know, if you look at what's happened in Chile, you know, these kind of over the past 3-4 years, you know, the political kind of transformation of that country has been, it's a 180 degree turn basically, and that has happened through popular mobilization. And I think that's where I see that's where I have a problem, is how this idea of urgency is actually constantly used as a means as well of depoliticizing the climate debate, or of preventing kind of alternative views from emerging by saying, you know, yes, you want to talk about, you know, you want to talk about social justice, you want to talk about these other issues which you connect to the climate crisis, but we first need to address, you know, greenhouse gas emissions, we need to limit our emissions, and then we'll have time to have those discussions, you know. And I think that's a fundamental danger, I would say, especially, and I think this is another thing we can respond, is how this group of people have actually been pushing this narrative and pushing this approach for the past 20 or 30 years now. I mean, so the narrative of urgency is a kind of an ongoing narrative that is never ending in itself. You know, we're constantly pushing back this idea. So, you know, if you go back to the 1990s, you know, we had to take action by 2010. Now we're talking about 2030, we're talking about 2050. I mean, we're constantly pushing back this frontier. And so that's what I have a problem with, is their inability, and also to a certain extent, our inability to actually say, well, wait a minute, it's actually the same people who have been pushing this narrative and this approach for the past 30 years. At what point do we actually hold them accountable for what has happened and the lack of action that's been taking place? You know, how come, you know, someone like Al Gore is actually never really questioned about, you know, his responsibility to a certain extent, or the validity of his approach, you know, given that he's been in the game for so long? You know, I could take other examples like Christiana Figueres. You know, there's just so many examples of people who occupy this space, you know, and at the same time, who constantly refer to this idea of urgency but who at the same time have been there for 30 years or so, you know. So I guess that's my idea behind this work, is to try and say, well, wait a minute, you know, let's take a step back and let's just also reflect on, you know, not just the message, but the messenger, and the extent to which, you know, the messenger is possibly wrong in his approach, or maybe we could explore a different approach to this issue, and also to try and understand why they push the same narrative constantly, you know, which, as I say, is a narrative and a strategy which for me has not really functioned.
Funnily enough, in our circles, sometimes we fear that they will pick up on our own ideas. And I guess that co-optation is always something that we fear, that those people you're talking about will one day start using the terminology that we're using, and they will start churning it, and somehow when they start using words like degrowth or planetary boundaries or these kind of terminologies, they will still represent completely different narratives.
Yep.
From those who came up with these meanings in the first place.
Yep.
Do you see that as a threat? When you were talking about Greta Thunberg and how much they would like to have her in their circles, This is what came to my mind as well, that's a kind of co-optation.
Yeah.
Of a person, but we're talking about co-optation of words and meanings. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's a credible threat?
I think it's, yeah, I mean, I think it's already underway. I mean, I think if you listen to the kind of narrative and how it's evolved, I mean, I think that's another thing that I find really interesting, is how adaptable the narrative is. I mean, there was clearly a moment, and I think that 2016 with the election of Trump was kind of a moment, I think, in the kind of history of this group of people that I'm interested in, because I think it was clearly something that they had never expected. It was really unexpected. And I think, you know, his whole narrative around, you know, Trump digs coal, this kind of narrative, which was, you know, very centered on, you know, the US kind of white working class that was kind of losing out as a result of the low carbon transition, in particular, you know, coal communities in the Appalachia, for instance. I think that kind of had a triggering effect on these elites, in the sense that they, from that moment on, if you look, it's really interesting to see how their narrative began to change and how suddenly justice and social justice in particular began to was taken up through concepts like just transition. They reappropriated in particular that concept of just transition at that moment. But just recently as well, I mean, last year when we had the 2020, sorry, with George Floyd, you know, and the Black Lives Matter and all these mobilizations that were taking place, it's really interesting to see how, you know, suddenly we're seeing kind of more diversity within these elite groups, but also at the same time how they've also taken up these kind of narratives around racial justice and connecting it as well to the climate debate. So they're very good at reappropriating narratives, you know, and they're increasingly also talking about systems change. You know, this is something we're seeing more and more of. I think that I think it is a threat, but at the same time, I think that's also where movements and where also to a certain extent, kind of academics have to kind of step in a way. I think it's also very important to that's why I think it's also very important to point out that they are reappropriating, you know, to really kind of push back as well on these efforts, you know. I think because the inevitable outcome is the emptying of these concepts of their kind of transformational potential, and I think that's a real issue. But it is clearly something that we are seeing.
You studied the role of philanthropic foundations in global climate politics. What has been the role in the past of these philanthropic foundations in putting climate change on the political agenda? And what part do they play now?
Well, there are kind of different phases. I think there was a first phase, I guess, at the beginnings of the kind of international climate debate. So in the 80s, for instance, you know, foundations, it's like Rockefeller Foundation, for instance, played quite a big, or Rockefeller Brothers Foundation in particular, played a big role actually in funding some of the research around climate change. But they also began to fund networks of academic, of researchers in particular, you know, getting them together, getting them to think collectively, and also getting them to also frame the climate issue as a fundamentally political one, in the sense that, you know, it needed to be taken up by governments and political actors. So that was a kind of 1980s effort. In the 1990s, they also provided a lot of support for the establishment, I mean, in the late 80s of the IPCC, but in the 1990s as well of the UNFCCC. So funding, for instance, the participation of delegates from the Global South to the preparatory meetings, also funding the creation of NGO networks. So CAN, the Climate Action Network, for instance, you know, benefited from quite a lot of support from foundations. And the idea here, and this was in the context where we're increasingly talking about global civil society, the idea here was to establish or create kind of a global civil society around climate change. Yeah, and their idea behind that was to say that, you know, if we do that, we can exert pressure, in particular on the United States, to actually take this, you know, take up this issue and commit to finding kind of a global solution to the problem. From the years 2000, in particular in the lead up to Copenhagen, we see kind of a new wave of foundations emerging. In particular, and what's interesting with these foundations, a number of them were actually established in the West Coast of the United States, so around Silicon Valley, around San Francisco. And they have very close ties historically through their founders, in particular to the kind of West Coast kind of tech industry, but also with venture capital. And they kind of bring, I guess, their idea is to kind of bring a new approach towards climate philanthropy, one that is more strategic, one that is more, one that kind of also frames philanthropy more as an investment. So this kind of idea that, you know, when we give money to an organization or we fund an initiative, we want a return on our investment, you know, in terms of, you know, lowered emissions, for instance. So very centered as well on the production of data. So again, you see this kind of new wave of philanthropy emerge, and this is the one that is currently kind of still dominant within the international climate space. And from the outset, you know, it's a philanthropy as well that kind of pushed market-based solutions, that pushed also, I mean, in the lead up to Copenhagen, there was a big focus on carbon capture and storage, this idea of new kind of technologies, but also a focus on kind of energy efficiency, renewable energy promotion as well. And so what's interesting with this philanthropy, or the kind of current climate philanthropy, or the kind of dominant actors within that space, is how, yeah, they are very interconnected, and they all share kind of a fairly similar approach, you know, towards the climate issue. And so that, I guess, poses a number of problems, I think, as well, for movements who kind of depend on these philanthropies, because effectively it means that, you know, you are effectively shopping in one source, and that means that, you know, you also have to adapt to a certain extent your approach in order for it to fit with, you know, the approach that is being promoted and pushed by these funders.
When you talk about these foundations, do they actually include the most well-known ones, like Greenpeace or Worldwide Foundation, or the ones that we know or presume as average people that they are actually fighting kind of against this narrative or?
I mean, I think in terms of the foundations, I mean, things are changing and evolving constantly. I mean, just recently, for instance, there was the Bezos Earth Fund was set up by Bezos, and that kind of marks a kind of a revolution within the climate philanthropy space, just because of the sheer amount of money that he's putting on the table. But, you know, since Copenhagen, basically, the space has been dominated by foundations that are maybe less well known. I mean, I'm thinking in particular of the Climate Works Foundation, which is based in San Francisco, and connected to the Climate Works Foundation are kind of regional foundations, like the European Climate Foundation, for instance, in Europe, but also the Energy Foundation in the US and China. So there are foundations, as I say, that don't necessarily seek to be visible, but they do seek to be influential, you know, and that means that they have a lot of in-house kind of capacity, which I guess is also quite interesting, because they do a lot of work themselves in a way. You know, they have expertise, they have in-house expertise, which means that they have a very clear as well idea of what they want. And so they're very selective in terms of who they fund. And if they fund someone, it's clearly because they feel that that organization can actually contribute to the kind of theory of change or the strategy that they already have in mind. You know, another interesting example is the Children's Investment Fund Foundation in the UK, you know, which is also quite a big actor. But again, all these foundations are actually very interconnected. You have people sitting on each other's boards, but also, you know, the European Climate Foundation, for instance, actually is a pass-through foundation in the sense that its own funding comes from other foundations like Climate Works, like Hewlett in the US, like Packard in the US, et cetera, et cetera. And so that creates kind of a very interconnected web of foundations who, as I say, are also connected by a shared kind of idea of what is needed and what is needed and what's the best approach to promote. And when you ask them why, you know, what kind of justifies this strategy, they will respond, you know, that climate philanthropy there isn't that much money. It's only 2% of total philanthropy. So they constantly refer to the comparatively small amount of money available for philanthropy on climate change. And therefore they say, well, given that there's not a lot of money, we need to be very strategic. You know, we need to use it in the most strategic way in order to leverage the greatest impact. You know, so it's this kind of idea of, you know, being the most efficient with the money that we have that kind of justifies this kind of interconnection between the foundations and this development of shared approaches towards the field. But as I say, that generates also a form of groupthink, which I think is also quite dangerous, because it also means that alternative perspectives and alternative views actually, you know, they have a very hard time kind of emerging. It's very difficult to push kind of a different agenda because, you know, the sources of funding are all funding the same thing, effectively.
Listening to you made me think that we don't tend to really think the difference between civil society and bottom-up initiatives and kind of the business sphere. And when I listen to you, you know, I have this question, like, how can I distinguish between the civil sector and the business sector when they are so strongly intertwined?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's absolutely right. I think it's a really good point. I mean, I think I have a lot of difficulty in making that distinction myself. You know, I think also, you know, because of the people, you know, there's also kind of a revolving door phenomenon as well that's quite interesting to analyze. There's, you know, there's a lot of fluidity, let's say, between business philanthropy movements, you know, including think tanks and, you know, NGOs that are not kind of profit seeking. So I think that's also why I feel it's useful to sometimes focus on the people, on the individuals, how effectively it is also a lot about people, you know, about people and networks of people that go beyond the organizations to which they are affiliated. You know, it's almost like a community of like-minded individuals who kind of share a common idea, a common view of what needs to be done, and who therefore, you know, leverage their respective organizations as well to try and get the kind of narrative and the debate around climate change to go in the direction that they want to go. And as I say, I think it's something that's quite visible, especially when you do kind of ethnographic research, for instance, at COPs. You can see the kind of those kind of groups of individual kind of come together, so people who are, working for a delegation, a country delegation, someone from 350, someone from WRI, someone from the, the World Business Council Sustainable Development, and someone from philanthropy, just having a chat together around the table and kind of, coordinating their efforts and coordinating their work. As I said, I think it's nothing new. I don't think I'm kind of discovering anything. However, what's interesting is that how in the climate space, there isn't really an alternative. It's just they dominate that space so much, which means that, all different voices or critical voices, have a very hard time emerging as a result of that. Because as I say, there are very few sources of funding it's more or less, the space itself is actually not that big.
That's exactly what I'd like to turn our attention to. You mentioned, we don't have enough funding, or those representing alternatives have no funding. Mm-hmm. And again, playing the devil's advocate for a moment, if I were a major philanthropist, I'd say that the world and people would know next to nothing on climate change had I not founded this discourse before, mm-hmm. and had I not founded all the research and knowledge sharing on the topic. And of course, we are well aware of the limitations of these kind of consequentialist moral arguments. Mm-hmm. But just for the sake of self-reflection, how could we, representing alternative narratives, how could we have grabbed the attention of the wider public when, for example, the founders of ecological economics already expressed their concerns in the 70s? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point. And obviously, it's always hard to look back and say, well, had we not had these big foundations, what would have happened? Where would the debate lie at the moment had they not been there, had they not funded the initiatives that they funded, et cetera, et cetera? I think we could, and I think, they can legitimately argue that awareness of the problem would be, there'll be less awareness of the problem. At the same time, I would tend to say that, there are other ways of kind of communicating the climate crisis in particular. And I think that's an actor that's constantly downplayed and criticized in particular by these actors. It's the role of the state, the state as well as kind of an actor in the debate, and how the state can also play a role in raising awareness about a problem, educating people about a problem, etc. And I think that's, again, that's kind of an elephant in the room for these types of actors. When they talk to the state, when they refer to the state, they always refer to it in a pejorative manner. They always refer to the state as a bureaucracy, as something that's slow. They always accuse the state of being responsible for the lack of action. And in doing so, they also reinforce their own status. They also legitimize themselves as actors within that space. Because when you think of it, that's the thing that they also, that's a problem that they have. And I'm thinking in particular of philanthropic foundations, is that they are not legitimate actors, or in the sense they are not accountable actors. Whereas the state is accountable, it's accountable to the people, theoretically, at least in democratic, in democratic states. So I'd probably be slightly less, I would tend to probably argue that, I think they have possibly played a role, but at the same time, the state has also historically played an important role. And as I say, also movements, and I think if you just take another example where philanthropic foundations tend to say that they played a big role, civil rights in the United States, for instance, the civil rights movement is a movement that didn't emerge because of philanthropy. know, philanthropy stepped in, and actually a number of scholars actually say that philanthropy played a detrimental role on that movement because it contributed to kind of channel the movement, you know, to limit the scope of its demands, which were actually quite revolutionary, you know. And we were mentioning, you know, it was Martin Luther King Day a few days ago. You know, when you look at early, you know, speeches of Martin Luther King, he was talking about, you know, racism, but he was also talking about social justice. You know, he was talking about a lot of other themes. He was actually carrying a very radical transformative narrative. So as I say, I think that movement existed before. That movement would have existed anyway without philanthropy. And to a certain extent, you could argue that philanthropy was there to try and control the movement and to try and limit, you know, its scope, limit its transformative potential. So, you know, to come back to your question, you could almost say that maybe we would have, you know, you could say that possibly without philanthropy, things would have moved further, moved faster. We would maybe have framed as well the climate crisis differently. You know, we would have maybe from the outset integrated, you know, the social dimensions of the crisis. We would have maybe from the outset also not focused so blindly as well on kind of emissions but integrated other kind of factors as well, you know. And so we would have maybe even, you know, we would maybe be in a much better place than we are today had they not intervened when they did.
What perspectives or tools civil society organizations have who represent an alternative to these foundations, and of course for them to be heard next to these kind of loud actors, it's really difficult. Also, what kind of revenue streams can they rely on?
Yeah, I mean, I think for a start, I think it's important to highlight that, you know, there are actors within philanthropy who do carry a different approach, who are more humble in their approach as well towards the work that they do, who also believe in the need to address, you know, all these other kind of connected issues, you know, justice related issues that we discussed before, and who also acknowledge that, you know, philanthropy is kind of a product of, you know, capitalism. And, you know, that philanthropy itself is a problem, you know, and that's what I, you know, and I think it's really important to highlight their existence, you know, and I engage and I interact with them. And what's also really interesting about these particular philanthropic actors is that they're actually also open to discussion. You know, they're always kind of constantly in a process of kind of self-reflection, a critical self-reflection as well. So, you know, those actors play a very important role because they support some of these groups who are kind of pushing these different narratives, you know. And in the US, there are a foundation that I particularly like is the Chorus Foundation, for instance, that is very active around and kind of the debate on just transition, but that kind of has also a very original approach towards its philanthropy, which is not to say, you know, what movements should do, but actually to trust movements and say, well, here's the money, you identify, you know, what needs to be done. And it's also, you know, a foundation that is a foundation that has an end date. So, you know, it's a foundation that is spending down all of its money. So it's not trying to invest its money to try and continue to exist indefinitely. You know, so its idea is to say, okay, we need to spend all the money that we have, you know, and so let's put the money there, out there. Let's get it to work, you know, and let's get it to push an agenda that's more aligned with climate justice. You have networks like the Edge Funders Alliance as well that kind of pushes these similar approaches. So you do have these actors. Again, at the same time, you know, the problem, I guess, is that they're very small, that they represent, you know, a drop in the bucket when compared to these bigger philanthropic actors. So, you know, they're an important tool, I think, for these kind of alternative approaches to emerge and to spread. And at the same time, I think, you know, again, I think I kind of come back to this, but I think it's also about also connecting, you know, these mobilizations more explicitly as well with kind of the political agenda in different countries. Now, I think that's another kind of leverage point. And we're starting to see that, you know, in the US, what's happening around the Green New Deal, you know, the kind of the debates, you know, that are happening within the Democratic Party in the US are very interesting from that perspective, this kind of idea. And so we're starting to see a bit of that take place. And the fact that in the US, we're seeing that is really encouraging, I would say. But it's this kind of idea that, you know, we actually need to take power. You know, we need to kind of, it's about, you know, controlling government. It's about, you know, using government as an instrument for transformational change. And as I say, the fact that we're seeing that in the US is really interesting because I guess, you know, for a long time and still today, there's a real distrust of, you know, government in the US. Also within kind of the left and left-wing kind of climate movements as well. This kind of idea that, you know, there's nothing to expect from the state. We shouldn't trust the state. It's actually something that's very present within movements itself. And that has been to a certain extent promoted by foundations as well. This kind of idea that, you know, don't trust the state, you know, here's our money. Don't trust the state, trust us in a way. But again, I think things are starting to change. And I think that's another kind of leverage point that's really interesting. And, you know, and if you look at a country like France, where I am, where, you know, what's interesting to see is how the climate movement here is also far less reliant on kind of private money to function. Because, you know, traditionally the state occupies a bigger space and the state has funded movements active around kind of climate action as well. So I think there are still kind of levers to do things. And, you know, at the same time as well, I think, again, if you look at Chile, resources are part of the problem you need resources to take action, but you don't just need financial resources. You know, I think human resources are key. And, you know, mobilizations can actually spread very quickly. From the moment that you have that kind of critical mass, you know, things can change very, very rapidly as well.
Thank you very much for this great podcast. But before you go, to close out this episode, I ask you the question I ask all my guests. What is your rebellion?
Well, as I said, I think my rebellion and I don't know if it qualifies as a rebellion, but it's just I guess what really is important for me is to kind of constantly try to kind of intentionally break away from this sense of urgency that you referred to. I mean, it's very hard because I think the urgency, we feel the urgency constantly, and you know, in our private lives as well. You know, I have children, I'm worried about their future. But at the same time, I feel that if we're not able to kind of take a step back, especially us as kind of social scientists, you know, us as academics, I think it is important for us to be able to break away from that urgency and to also critically reflect on, you know, those who are pushing this narrative of urgency and why they are doing it. I think they are doing it obviously in part because we need to act fast, but at the same time, I think it's also important to also possibly reflect on other reasons, you know, for pushing that narrative, which are actually, and one in particular is this kind of idea of pushing a one-size-fits-all approach to what needs to be done. And I think, you know, that one-size-fits-all approach has actually been pushed for a number of years now, and it hasn't necessarily produced the results that that were expected. And I think, you know, we need to critically reflect on that as well. So as I say, that means really taking a step back from the urgency. And I think that's where we can play kind of a meaningful role as well in the debates that are taking place within movements as well, you know, who are also faced with that urgency, but, you know, they're also faced with the urgency of finding funding for their actions. They're also faced with the urgency of kind of organizing and strategizing for mobilizations. You know, and I think we can really contribute by taking that step back, you know, and reflecting on, you know, what all this means.
Thank you very much. Many thanks to Edouard and thanks to all of you for spending time with us. Stay tuned with us for our next episode. Bye, Edouard.
Bye, thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. If you like the conversation and your work is related to ecological economics in any discipline, consider becoming a member of our society to stay connected. If you are ready to discuss the topic, join our Facebook group called European Society for Ecological Economics.